figure out the sources. Let me just pass it around, please. Two sides. Okay, let me refresh your memory as to where we're up to, because we're kind of ended in the middle last time, having run out of time. So the Agadita begins with a prelude, or preface, by Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, that a Bas Kol emerges on a daily basis and asserts that the entire world is sustained as the result of the tzidkus of Rav Chanina ben Dosa, who requires himself no more than a kaf keruvin to survive. Then, after that preface, the actual story begins, the Agadita begins. Every Erev Shabbos, the wife of Rav Chanina ben Dosa used to heat up her kitchen with an oven and bring about lots of smoke, because she was embarrassed at her impoverished state and didn't want the neighbors all to talk about how they had no money. And so she kind of simulated cooking Erev Shabbos by creating the smoke in the kitchen. The Gemara says because she was embarrassed. And then the Gemara relates how she had a really nasty neighbor who knocked on the door, wanted to show her up for being the hypocrite and the liar that she believed her to be, and knocked on the door, and she said, you know, what's going on here? What's all the smoke? And so Rechina Mendoza's wife escapes to the inner chamber. We talked about that. And I think that's where we left off, right? Where we left off, at the inner chamber? Right? So she escaped to the inner chamber. So everybody with me? That's the basic Agadita up until this point. Obviously, we discussed it and analyzed it. But that's the summary of what transpired. Just to review some of the themes that we talked about last week, we talked about the way in which emotion sometimes is dissonant with a person's knowledge, and even though on the one hand she never complained about her poverty beforehand, we have no evidence that she complained. So presumably she believed in the tzidkus of her husband and that ideal way of life, and nevertheless she still felt embarrassed. Why would she feel embarrassed? Because even though she knew they were doing the right thing, emotionally she didn't fully identify with it, and there was a dissonance between her emotions and her beliefs, which is very, very common in life. We talked about this rather nasty neighbor, and her motivations may have been her own feelings of guilt at the bourgeois life she led, in comparison to these very, very high ideals, so she needed to maybe knock her off her pedestal to kind of show that, well, you're really not so great as you think you are. So that may have been a partial motivation for her nastiness. We also talked about how when she went into this inner chamber to escape, it may have been not only to escape literally the neighbor, but also to escape the shame that she might have felt over her shame, because she may have herself realized that there was a kind of hypocrisy in her own place, and that she shouldn't have felt ashamed if she was doing the right thing. Rav Chanina Mendoza wasn't ashamed, so why was she ashamed? So some of the themes we addressed. So that's what we're up to, I believe. So let's continue with 1, 2, 3, 4, the fourth line down on page on Daf Chaf Hei Amud Aleph. Everybody with me? Okay. So the Gemara continues. That Asavid La Nisa, a miracle was done for her, for the wife of Chanina Mendoza. Chazya l'tanura mole lachma. We might have read this last week too. She saw a tanur full of bread, va'agna mole lisha, and she found a basket full of dough to be kneaded. And so a miracle was performed, and lo and behold, this nasty neighbor discovers that there is actually bread in the oven and the whole thing is not a fake, which is obviously a miracle. This that wasn't the case originally.
Still just bread. It's still just bread.
Yes, you're right. It's still just bread. But for her, that was quite a kutz, you know, having bread, because all she had was carob bread. Of course, nowadays, you could probably get carob bread at a very fancy bakery, and it'll cost you $10 a loaf. But anyway. So she says, Palnisa, Palnisa. So-and-so, so-and-so. Like Plony, Plony, but the female version in Aramaic is Palnisa, Palnisa. Mrs., Mrs., you know. I see masa de kacharech lachmach. Go bring a shovel, because your bread is burning. So, amra la. So she responded to her, af ana lahachi aili. And that's really why I went up to in the inner chamber to go. I went to the broom closet, you know, the closet to pick up a shovel. Is that a true statement or a false statement? It's false, right? It's false. Because the Gemara, as the Agadah tells us, she went up there, why? Because she was ashamed, not because she wanted to get. So she's telling a white lie. So now, before I go back and comment on this, let's just finish this little piece. Now the Agadah takes a break, and something happens. There is an interpolation into the Agadah. You know what interpolation means? What does the word interpolation mean?
We introduce something.
Right, something that's introduced that is a break from the full narrative, the full text. Somebody interpolates something. Inter means in the middle. Polate, I don't know what that means. Pole, whatever. You stick something in the middle. So all of a sudden this Tana appears and breaks the story. So this is not the original narrative. It's an interpolation, a break into the Agadata. Tana. Af hi lahavi merda nichnasa. She too, in fact, went to get a shovel. Bipnei shem lumedes benisim. Because she is accustomed to having miracles all over the house. So, how do you read this interpolation, this Tana? Like, is this a good shot in the Agadata? Well, it can't be a good shot in the Agadata, because was she telling the truth or lying? We just established that she was lying. And why? Because the Agadata said she went into the inner chamber because the Agadata explicitly says, Mishum Kisufa, she was embarrassed. That's why she smoked the kitchen. And it says specifically, Ichsufa v'ayla l'indarna. She got embarrassed and she went into the Agadata itself, in contrast to the, I'll call this Tana the interpolator. It sounds like the terminator here. The interpolator. So, the interpolator, the Tana, is providing an explanation of the Agadata that is entirely inconsistent with the Agadata itself. Does that strike you as a little odd? Why is the interpolator, this Tana, doing that? By the way, nameless, we don't know who this Tana is. We don't know who the author of this Agadata is, by the way, either. It's another thing. We don't know how far back it goes. Rav Chanina Mendoza lived, by the way, around the same time as Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, so this is after the Churban HaBayis. It's 1st century CE. So it's a period of the Tanaim. So if there was a contemporaneous interpolator, he would have been a Tana. He would have been at that period, but we don't know anything about who he is. Anyway, be all that as it may, how can the Tana interpret the Agadata in ways that are entirely inconsistent with the Agadata itself? Why is the Tana doing this?
The earlier suggestion was there's a dissonance in her own behavior, right? That while she might have acted in a certain way, which was...
You know, speak up, really loud.
She was acting in a certain way which would live this aesthetic life, but she still felt a certain way. So perhaps her running into the room, while it's motivation, might have been this emotional thing. If Milomedes could also be understood like a habit, that was part of her habit, right? Her habit was to act in a way...
So I'm not clear. Why did she hide? Because she was embarrassed, or because she was really... going there to get the shovel because she expected there to be...
Maybe it's an expression of dissonance. One, on the one hand, part of her motivation is this embarrassment, but on the other hand, part of her is accustomed to acting in a way that Nisa Martin.
Did she tell a lie or not? Let me put it in those terms. White lie.
I mean, the answer could possibly, according to this Tana, yes and no.
According to the Tana, she went in there, he specifically says, because she was going to get the shovel, so she wasn't lying. So what was the lie?
The lie was...
There's no lie. She specifically said that af ana lahachi aile, that's why I went there. And the Tana is saying, in fact, that's, you know, that was true. That's why she went there. But the Agadita says she went there not because of that, because she was embarrassed.
Perhaps even in her behavior to go inside reflects this dissonance, and that she's both partially motivated by her own embarrassment and acting.
I hear what you're saying, but I just don't think... I think you're working too hard to reconcile two different teachings. I don't think they're reconcilable. Yes?
Can it be that she went there because she was embarrassed of what she did to make the smoke in the first place?
Right.
So she was embarrassed, and she got the broom up there to then clean up her mess of embarrassment.
The embarrassment...
She was embarrassed that she made the smoke in the first place.
She did this every Erev Shabbos. It's like nothing, this particular Shabbos. Every Erev Shabbos. I don't think it was a mess. It says ketores, that she stuck some kind of whatever into the... There was an oven, she... we have any pre-med science guys here? Like, what do you do to create smoke? You just throw something in there? Some chemicals she threw in there, whatever it was, and it created smoke. I don't think it even made a mess. And she used to do this all the time.
Today she's embarrassed. Meaning this one occurrence, and we said that she might be even ashamed of her shame.
Right, but remember it says the word kisuf appears twice. And it appears first to explain why she threw the smoke in. And second, it appears after the neighbor came and pounded on the door, ichsafavi ailulav, she was embarrassed and she went inside. So this Agadita speaks of a dual embarrassment in this particular day, generally, a general embarrassment, which is why she put the smoke in today, and specific embarrassment at the arrival of the neighbor who's going to catch her being a faker, which is, of course, very, very embarrassing if she doesn't want to be caught in that compromised position. Yes?
The question is, when it comes to the second embarrassment, there could be different options of what it is she's embarrassed about. The first embarrassment is that I don't have anything to make for Shabbos. The second embarrassment is either she's going to come in and see that I don't have anything, and then the whole first thing I was embarrassed about, I'm going to be realized to be a fraud.
Right.
The other possibility is she's going to see that I tried to cover up.
Yeah.
Which is very different, meaning...
Right, I agree with you. Right. But yeah, both. Yeah, I agree with you. You're absolutely right. Anyway, back to the question I asked. We don't need to try to reconcile them. In other words, I don't think, at least from my perspective. The Agadita tells one tale. The Tana, who the interpolator, as I'm calling him, was uncomfortable with that story. How is it possible, this Tana is saying, that this great Sadegis from Chanina Mendoza would tell a lie? How is it possible that this great Sadegis would be embarrassed? She's married to the Tzaddik of all Tzaddikim, Chanina Mendoza. And Chanina Mendoza wouldn't have been embarrassed. How could she have been embarrassed? She couldn't have been embarrassed. Their life was full of nisim, like Chanina Mendoza's life in general was, as the whole sugya in Tainus makes clear. And the Tana just disagrees with this version of the story that the Agadita has. It's you know, the Tana comes to disagree, not to, in effect, to provide an alternative reading of what actually transpired, because the Tana could not accept that the wife of Chanina Mendoza would have been embarrassed and would lie.
So is the Tana lying?
Is the Tana lying? It's an interesting question. Nobody was exactly actually around. You have to remember that these stories, there were no cameras taking pictures of what was going on at that time. Nobody could take a picture of what was going on internal to Chanina Mendoza's wife. Nobody knows what her feelings are. Right. So far, nobody's discovered a camera that can elucidate a person's hidden feelings. Thank God. Can you imagine if there were cameras all over the place and they could record what we're really feeling about things? That would be really very bad for social cohesion, for family life, for a shalom bayis. Can you imagine if every feeling you had were fully expressed and out there? That's like, to my mind, the story of a science fiction nightmare. So there is no camera. So nobody knows exactly what she's feeling. So there was some story going around about what happened to Joaquin Mendoza's wife. And these are different readings of those events that, you know, happened a while ago that nobody was present for, that nobody could really gain access into the individual's inner feelings. So that's okay.
How did they get the story in the first place?
How did the story start? Nobody really knows. I mean, I assume it was grounded in some kind of fact. Maybe the neighborhood was talking about it. The neighbor talked about it. Nobody really, I don't really know. It's a good question. Nobody really knows the origin of many of these stories. But they're probably grounded in some actual event that transpired. And, you know, you ever heard stories about Rebbes? Or, you know, like a Chassidish Rebbe, the Maiselach about Chassidish Rebbes, or, you know, maybe you have stories about Yon Rabbeim here at Lander or Rabbeim in Eretz Yisrael. You know, you hear stories about them, like nobody knows exactly what happened and who was there. You know, maybe it happened 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So it's the Maiselach. They, you know, these are Maiselach from the Gemara. So you have, they're very serious, which is why we're spending so much time analyzing them, because it's a Gemara. It's not Stam. It's not a Rebbe Shemaisa. So it has tremendous importance and eternal value. But nevertheless, going back to the origins of it, nobody is totally clear about these things. And the Tana and the Baal HaGadata were disagreeing about what was going on inside her life. Now, one way to understand, as it were, the machlokas between the Tana, the interpolator, and the Baal HaGadata is what was the level of tzidkus of Joaquin Mendoza's wife? Is she the sort of person who would be embarrassed or not? Baal HaGadata is comfortable with pegging Rabbi Hanina Mendoza's wife down a notch by attributing embarrassment to her. Baal HaGadata is also comfortable attributing a white lie to Rabbi Hanina Mendoza's wife, right? We could make clear that according to the Baal HaGadata itself, she was lying. Whereas the Tana is not comfortable with portraying Rabbi Hanina Mendoza's wife as anything less than a supreme tzaddikus. So that may be part of the question, what was her life like? But if you probe a little deeper, there might even be another explanation, which to my mind maybe rings truer, which is not whether Rochanina Mendoza's wife was at tzaddik level A or at tzaddik level A minus, tzaddikus level A minus, but think about this. What tzaddik level is sufficient for Uli's nisim? How big a tzaddik you need to be to justify or to make possible Uli's nisim? In other words, you have pure tzaddik, or Chanina Mendoza, who, you know, emerges in all of these Sipurim and the Agadita and our Agadita as being, and we'll see, we haven't met him yet, we'll soon meet him, and he's really quite an impressive man in ways that we might not even anticipate. So he's like an incredible tzaddik. So we got it. You know, nisim happened to Rabbi Hanina Mendoza. But can nisim happen for someone who is not at that level of tzidkus? She's at the A-minus level of tzidkus because she's embarrassed. She doesn't fully identify with the world of Rabbi Hanina Mendoza's poverty and asceticism. She only partially identifies with it, or cognitively yes, emotionally no. She tells a white lie. What does it take to be zoche to extraordinary tzaddikim, to extraordinary nisim? So the Agadita is saying shades of great tzidkus are okay. Doesn't have to be perfect. You know, perfect is perfect. You don't have to be perfect. Shades of great tzidkus is also okay for nisim. And the Tana is saying no. Nisim, no shades of great.
Wouldn't he have explained the first part of this Agadita?
Excuse me?
Wouldn't this Tana then have to explain the rest of the...
Why was she embarrassed? Yes. Right. Yeah, I think that this Tana has a different version of the story and a different version of her behavior and motivations. He can't live with any compromised picture of Joaquin Mendoza. It's like, you know, this, it's not identical to. So, make it clear. It's not identical to, but it's reminiscent of the Machlokas Rishonim about whether the Avos can sin. You know, whether the Avos and the Chumash, are they capable of sin or not? It goes back to the Gemara. Kol Omer David Chata, whoever says David Chata, you know, Ein Ela Toa, you know, it's a big mistake. Great Gedolin in Tanakh can't do sins. On the other hand, as is well known, the Ramban in Chumash takes a different view. And, you know, throughout his Perush al Torah, he finds or sees fault in the Maisa Avos, and that's exactly why it's in the Torah. So we can learn from it. You know, we can learn from it. So what does it take to be a class A Aleph plus Tzaddik for Nisim? So you have a similar tension, going back to the Mefarshim and the Chumash, as to whether or not perfection is required, or even shades of gray perfection are okay. And it could be that this Tana and our Agadita are struggling with that important question. What does it take? Can you be a shade of great tzaddik to merit great nisim, to merit wonderful things? So I think Ellie, I was sort of I'm going down the table. Ellie first, and then again.
Well, I would think that the Baal Agadita has a better praise of the wife, because she's... Who says that it's better to... she feels good what she's doing, and she knows what she's doing is right, as opposed to her emotion pulling her back, and still she's overcoming a physical emotion. It's really, I mean, it's her mind versus her emotions.
And she still overrides her emotions. That's a very interesting point. Very, very interesting point. You know, it's... is reminiscent of the famous Rambam in Shmona Prakim Perek Vav, about who the better person is, the person who controls his Yetzirah to do a chet and overcomes it, or somebody who doesn't even have a Yetzirah to do the chet at all, who's the better person. So what you're saying is, look, she had these emotions, which is in effect a kind of Yetzirah, and she controlled it, so in that sense she was better. So that's an interesting observation. Yes?
Perhaps according to this understanding that they're arguing about, like, why the nis would have occurred, it's not that maybe that the Baal Agada is more liberal with what you need to be to get a nis like this, but actually only someone who's embarrassed Hashem would make the nis for, because if the person is really confident in doing the Matzah Hashem, why did Hashem really need to make a nis for one like this?
I'm not sure I follow what you're saying. Could you repeat it?
That the Baal Agada says that if she was like the Tana,
right,
treats her, then of course Hashem would have really made a nis for her, because she doesn't really need the nis. There's nothing that she's lacking that Kosh Baruch Hu needs to make a nace to fulfill.
And therefore?
She doesn't actually care about the bread, and she's not embarrassed. So why would they make a nace? Obviously, there's something inferred that's lacking, that a Kosh Baruch Hu is showing some compassion for her, and she's making a nace.
Okay, interesting observation, yes? Thank you, Yohanan.
No,
yes.
My question's answered.
Okay, fine. All right, so be all that as it may. by the way, is it always wrong to tell a lie? No. Actually, I think maybe the next Agadah we'll learn is about the question of lying and truth-telling. Because there's a guy, famous, kind of pretty well-known Agadah, about somebody who wanted to live the Eretz Kushta, where they only told the truth. Maybe we'll do that next time. But, I mean, you know, we all know that there are times when white lies are justified. For example, Shalom Bias is an example. So, what's that?
I was going to say, then the Shalom Tzal Moshe, Tzal Parah, that we're just going to give.
I can't hear you.
When Hashem told Moshe to tell Paro that we're just going to give Karbanos of the Midbar,
that's a Mefarshim discussed that, how I could lie. But anyway, maybe we'll look at that Agadah, but it's not clear that even if what she told was a white lie, it was such a terrible thing to do. For Shalom, she didn't want to, you know. Maybe cast negative aspersions on the house of Rabbi Hanina Mendoza, the great tzaddik. You know, there one could find a justification for it. Not clear that it's so bad. Be all that as it may, let's continue with the Gemara. So now, this moment marks a pivot in Rabbi Hanina Mendoza's wife, as we'll see. What is her name? She doesn't have it. She is called either the wife of Hanina Mendoza or Palnisa, which is the equivalent of saying nobody, you know, no name. She has no name. Would you call her proactive up until this point or reactive?
Reactive.
She reacts to the shame by putting smoke. She reacts to the neighbor by running away. She is a reactive, relatively passive person so far in the Agadita, and a very impressive person. She's living this life of great poverty, but reactive, passive, no name. Now this chains, this pivots right here at this moment. Amra le debisu. His wife, or she says, his wife, to husband, Rabbi Chanina Mendoza, I amas nasal v'nitztayer kulei hai. How long are we need to be suffering this much? All of a sudden, she speaks up. And not only does she speak up, she challenges Rabbi Chanina Mendoza. Up until this point, it's never happened. At least we have no record of it ever happening, and presumably it never did. So what do you think motivated this pivot in her persona? Like, why did she change? All these years, she was like living in poverty, never complaining, just smoking up the house. And now she's saying, hey, why are we living like this? How long do we have to live like this? Yes, very good. I think that the proximate cause for this pivot was the arrival of the neighbor, and I will ask you, Eitan, to explain why you think that would have caused that pivot.
She was embarrassed
of the poverty. She was embarrassed all along, but that, at one level, brought to the fore her embarrassment. Somebody was calling her on it. So that's point number one. It's more to it. I think that's part of it, and I think you're absolutely right. Grant, you want to add to that? It did happen, as we'll see.
You would agree that she challenged it?
Yes, because you'll see that there's the last line of this Agadita is another interpolation. So, yes, I think so. Anybody want to add to Eitan's, I think, correct observation that the catalyst for change on the part of Rabbi Chanina Mendoza's otherwise docile wife was this experience with a neighbor? So partly, you know, she was calling her on it. So that was clearly, yes, Ellie?
It might be the same thing, but it led to her doing more introspection on the whole situation in general.
Right. Yes, excellent. Remember, as we said last time, and I just summarized again this time, remember when she went into the inner chamber, I was suggesting that she didn't only go into a physical room, but she wanted to escape from her shame because she was ashamed over her shame. Because a truly great person wouldn't be ashamed at being poor, because if you think that you should be poor, then that's what you should be doing. So Rabbi Chanina Mendoza was probably never ashamed of being poor because that's the life he chose. She was ambivalent about that choice. So she wasn't living up to her own expectations for herself. And that failure to live up to her own expectations for herself would have led to feelings of shame and guilt. And so she was seeking to escape that shame. And at that moment, that's, I think Ellie mentioned last time, the inner citadel, kind of going into that place in yourself. She was so mortified by what she feels that she had become, that she felt, I need to change. We just need to change things. I can't live in this inner space of conflict and shame, and I'm not where I need to be. I see I've confronted my own limitations, he's saying. I've confronted the fact that I'm really not where you are. I'm ashamed. I shouldn't be ashamed. I'm really not at the level of tzidkus where I can live this kind of life of poverty. I've become hypocritical. I've been forced to lie. And I'm not ready for that. I'm not ready for your madrega, Rabbi Chanina Mendoza. That's really what she's telling her husband. So I think that this catalyst for change was a result of this, you know, mortifying encounter with her own limitations and her own shame, which she should never feel. And so she said, got to change. We got to do something. I'm not ready for this. I'm not ready for this. So now notice she said, at Amos nezo v'nitztayer kuli hai. That's singular or plural?
It's plural.
It's plural. Why does she say, why is this plural? Why is, I can't do it. At Amos ezo v'etztayer would be the singular. Why does she say in the plural? Yes, Grant?
She's not doing it alone. I mean, she might be in pain, but he's making her
right, so she, on Grant's reading, he is causing her pain, and she is confronting him with his role in her failure and shame and life of poverty and life of deprivation. And so she includes him, which is an interesting point. She sees themselves as like a unit, you know, we're together. Either you can't be poor, you know, it can't be the case that, you know, I'm just poor and you're not. We live together, you know, our financial circumstance, we have the same checkbook, we don't have two different checkbooks. You know, like some husbands and wives, you know, two different bank accounts, two different checkbooks. You know, we have the same checkbook, nothing in the bank, but we are in the same financial situation. And maybe also she didn't want to just take the blame herself. Maybe she wanted to, like, you know, share in the blame. Nezlovin and Star were both in pain. Maybe she was really asking Rukhini Mendoza to confront whether he has the same ambivalence that she has.
Potentially also look at this as she's deliberately not being accusatory. Right? I'm not blaming, she's not saying this from a place of pain, like, oh, it's your fault that I'm like this.
No, she's not accusatory.
Right, exactly. So she's saying Nezel to say more of like, this is like...
Together, we're in together. Right. It's not accusatory, but it's challenging. She challenges her husband. Right? Isn't she challenging? That's a dramatic thing to do. Particularly when your husband is the tzaddik hadar. Requires a lot of, you know, courage, really. Amos, Nezel, and it's Kulei Hayetz. As I say, it's a remarkable pivot from this docile, passive woman to all of a sudden she's like, okay, let's make a change. How long can we live like this? So it's quite a dramatic transformation. And my overall theme in this Agadita, and I'll develop this more and more, is this Agadita, as I mentioned, is a part of a series of Agadita's of Rav Chanina Mendoza, about all the great nisim that he did. My argument is that this particular Agadita is the main protagonist is not Rav Chanina Mendoza, it's really his wife. Rav Chanina Mendoza is a context for this. It's about Rav Chanina Mendoza's wife. But this is not primarily about Rav Chanina Mendoza's great miracle workings, although he'll do that. At the end of the day, the dramatis personae, if I can use that term. In other words, the person who's really changing and struggling and growing is his wife. It's really about how she could co-live. But it's very much like, as I think I mentioned to you last time, some of you may not have been here, I'll just refresh your memory. Like, let's say a wife of a kollel guy. You know, so she wanted a long-term learner, and she wanted somebody who's going to sit in, you know, Lakewood for 20 years and become the next Gadol Hador, and so she was maybe attracted to the guy, the top guy in Brisk, of which there are about 500. The top guy in Lakewood, of which there are about 5,000. You know, so that's why she married him, because she wanted somebody who was going to be like that. So in terms of her ideals, completely with Kolel. Now she has 7 kids, and his, you know, his Kolel stipend check is, you know, $200 or $300 a month, and mommy, you know, her father's resources have run out, and she has to go work, and they're living a very difficult, strained, impoverished life, which sometimes happens. I mean, I'm saying it happens all the time, but it sometimes happens. So as much as she might be committed to the ideals of Kolel life, doesn't mean that emotionally she's struggling with it. And I imagine, I'm not saying it's true for many or all, or even most, I don't know, but I imagine some Kolel wives would be in the same place as Rav Chanina Mendoza's wife. Like, and finally, she tells her husband after 15 years in Kolel, get a job, you know, like, go become a Rebbe or something. You may not be the Rosh Hashiva of Lakewood, but, you know, we need to bring... I'd aim as nasal than it's tired, Kulei. Like, one can hear this repercussing into contemporary life, and that's... She challenged him. Okay, now, his response, and now this is the first time he emerges on this, in the story, so now, whoa. This is the first encounter we see between husband and wife, which is very significant, and this is the first time he appears in the account. What can we learn about Rav Chanina Mendoza from his encounter with his wife, who was struggling and who was in pain? And I am...
Is he not there the whole time?
No, it's the first time he appears. Probably not. He was probably in the base medrash or, you know, davening or whatever. I don't know. Erev Shabbos, he probably wouldn't have been home. Maybe in the bath, the merchatz. In any case, I don't really know. But the first time he may says something, that we know for sure.
Does he know that she's making this smoke every week?
I don't know. Good question. That's a very good. It's a very good question, because if he knew that, then why didn't he do something about it? Why didn't he talk to her about it? That's a very good question. We don't know. The Baal HaGadot doesn't tell us. It's plausible that he wasn't there, because Erev Shabbos, people have stuff to do, and he was in the Beis Medrash, and he went to the Merchatz, and whatever he was doing, it's plausible he didn't know, but I really don't know, and that's a very, very good question. It requires really further thought on my part. In any case, what he says is, here's what he says. Amar La, he says to her, my Neved, what should we do? So her answer is obvious. By Rachame, Dines Vulach Midi. You are one of the great Mispalalim of all time, as the various Gemaras about Rav Akiva Mendoza make clear. He was an incredible Mispalal. Well, unleash your powers of tefillah and daven for us so that we can get some food. That's her response. So, what do you make of his response to her? She says, she challenges him, we don't have food, we need food. What are we going to do? How long do we have to live like this? And her his response is, what should we do? Well, how do you read that? How do you understand that? What am I supposed to do? I get a job? What am I supposed to do? Like, what do you think he's saying? It's a brilliant response. I think it's a brilliant response. I'm going to try to explain why I think that in a minute, but that primes you to think about his response. Yes?
It sounds like he's trying to gauge from her, what exactly is it that you want us to do? What do you think our next step should be? Because clearly you're in pain, but you haven't complained until now. And you know, until now, maybe I thought you agreed with this lifestyle. So what would you like our next step to be?
Okay, good, excellent. You're right. I'm going to build on that. Yes, go ahead.
I just think he wants to see why she's bothered. Meaning, if she answered that question, go get a job, then you would say that, oh, she's bothered by this whole, like, Tzaddik lifestyle. But she said, go daven to Hashem, which is more like on the Tzaddik lifestyle side of things. Not as just go get a job, leave this whole lifestyle. So he wants to see just where is she.
Okay, good. I think he wants to assess where she's at. I think you're right. I think you're right about that, Grant, and I think that's a good point. But what I hear in this, just following up on what you were saying, is that she is now emerging as a proactive, dynamic person who wants to grapple with and perhaps make changes in their life. And what he is, in effect, telling her is, it's not just me. We have to partner in this kind of challenge. He wants her to take responsibility for the life that they will lead. He doesn't want to tell her, okay, I'm going to adopt, because that's for him to take charge. He is inviting her into the inner sanctum of his life choices so that they can partner with those life choices. Remember, and then this again will emerge as the Agadah unfolds further. He could tell her, you know, tough. In Arsha. Yeah, okay, you know, I'm a great tzaddik, this is the life I want to lead, and you're my wife, and, you know, this is what you have to do. He's a great tzaddik. He's a husband. Husbands in ancient times had a lot more power over their wives than they do today. Husband, right? Husbandly authority, you know, you tell your wife what to do, and then, you know, I'm not saying that every wife always listened, but she was no doubt a very fine Beis Yaakov graduate, and she would have listened to her husband. So, husbandly authority, tzaddik authority, rabbinic authority. He's a great gadol. So, whatever he told her, she would probably abide by, and then, in fact, she's abided by it her whole life. But he absolutely refuses to impose any authority over her or impose anything on her. He's saying, you've raised an issue, come partner with me in trying to figure out how to resolve it. That is, he is empowering her. Whereas she was this little Beis Yaakov girl, as it were, you'll excuse the metaphor, who never complained, never did anything, always whatever, you know, carob for breakfast, carob for lunch, carob for dinner, never complained. And now he sees that she's evolved, that she's taken responsibility, and he dafka empowers that respect. Okay, you've emerged, you might say, from your chrysalis. You've become more of a person. Now you have to partner with me in resolving the challenges that we face. And he shows great respect for her, because he's inviting her into the challenge of trying to resolve this. He shows respect for her, empathy, sensitivity. He seeks to empower a wife who is now emerging more on her own. I think it's a brilliant and actually inspiring response. Something that not every Rav in ancient times would have done. And this, to my mind, is an expression of the Chassidus, the Tzidkus of Rav Chanina ben Dosa. All the usual tools of the trade that a powerful husband could have exercised over his wife, he throws to the wayside as if he ever would have considered using them, probably not. And he says, "My dear, what should we do? I take your suggestion seriously. You're my partner in this." I find that very moving and just a brilliant response. And her response, in turn, is, as kind of Grant was saying, is to build on that. And she says, "Daven, that's what you're good at. I'm not asking you to, you know, be a choniyam agil, you know, a wheel maker. I'm not asking you to be a water carrier, as some of the Tanaim were, you know. Daven, that's what you're good at. Daven." So there's a deep sort of spiritual communion between them, which she welcomes and invites. Notice that she says, by Rachame, Dnesvu Lach Mide. Nesvu Lach means what? Is that singular or plural?
Singular.
Before she said, Nezel, Admasai Nezel Venitstair in the plural. But now she switches the noun to singular. Get you. Why does she do that? Why does she switch? Why get us? Daven, so that we have food. How long do we need to suffer lacking her food? My Nevet, answer, Daven, so that we have food. Wouldn't that have been the most grammatically coherent way to put it? How do you understand the switch in grammar here?
She sees him as the conduit.
Good. Part of the answer, I think, is that he is the Tzadik Hadar. If your tefillahs are answered, it's for you, it's not for me. It's an expression of modesty on her part. I know who the tzaddik is. It's you. If Hashem provides us a nes, it's going to be for you. That's part of it. Another part of it, I think, is the following. Whose responsibility is it to earn the buck for the house? It's his responsibility. At the end of the day, the norm was for, unlike in contemporary kol life, where the norm is for the wives to support the husbands, in ancient times, the norm was, until pretty recently, for the husband to support the wife. So if you don't provide food for us, whose failure is it? Yours. You're not providing for our family. And therefore, it's given to you. It's absolving you of your failure to provide adequately for the family. Okay, let's continue. Bar Rachame, so he davened, Yatsasa kemin pisas yad, the palm of the hand came out. V'yovu le chad kara de petura de zava. And his palm from heaven came out and brought down a golden leg from a table. That's pretty dramatic. When's the last time you saw a hand come down from Shemayim and provide anybody with a golden leg of a table? Now how is this a solution to the problem? What are they supposed to do with the table? The golden leg. Sell it. It has material value. so what's with the table? What's with the leg? Like, that's, why doesn't Hashem just, you know, write him a check? You know, give them cash. What's with the label? So Agada 2 will explain it soon, but let's continue reading. It's getting a little late. So now, if you look at the next couple of lines carefully, you will see that there are parentheses and there are lots of Hagos Habach and Masoros Hashas, and they're, to shorten a longer story, there are two basic Gersos in the following Gemara. One is the Gersa of Rashi, which Rashi had. Excuse me. The other is a Gersa which is alluded to in these various Masoros Hashas, Hagos Habach. I actually did the research. You ever hear of a sefer called Dikduke Sofrim? What is it?
It's a compendium of different Gersos.
Correct. So this is not something that was published in the Jewish Theological Seminary. It goes back, I don't know, a long time ago, and it's in all Otzer's farm. Maybe we have it too. It's, you know, it's a standard work. And this person collected the different Gersos in the Gemara. So the other Gersa, the non-Rashi Gersa, is the other basic Gersa. So I'm going to read it first according to the Dikduke Sofrim, and then I'm going to read it separately according to Rashi. And the difference is, there's a dream here. The difference is who's the dreamer. Okay, so the Gemara continues. Chazai b'chalma. So our Gersa of Chazai is I saw, and that would be a reference to Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. So according to the Gersa in our Gemara, which is the Gersa of the Dikduke Sofrim, the dreamer is Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. By the way, just as an aside, just look at Rashi, just you see the alternative, three lines down. What's Rashi? Rashi doesn't say Chazai. What does Rashi read? Chazia. And who's the Chazia? Debitu b'chala. So for Rashi, the dreamer is the wife. But who's the dreamer? Okay, so now we're going to read the Gemara as our Gemara has it, Chazai, which is a Dukei Sofrim, and then we'll go back to Rashi. Chazai b'chama aside tzadike di achle abatura de dava de isla tlaskare. I saw in a dream that the Asad Lavo, the great tzaddikim of the world, will be eating at a table which has three legs. The Ihu, and I, meaning us, Ocheles Atura Apatura de Tre Kare, will be eating on a table with two legs. So he has a dream that if they use this table, they sell the legs of the table, or this leg of the table, then they will be deprived in Olam Haba. Because in Olam Haba, the tzaddikim eat at a table with three legs, and we'll be eating at a table with two legs. So this dream suggests that we're in a bad place if we sell the leg. I'm going to come back and analyze it, but let's just finish it. Amrale, or some would say Amar La, he said to her, no, this is really, if he had a dream, so he said to her, Nechal achte mechal achle kula alma absurd de mishalem vana absurd de machasar. Do you want us all, the two of us, to eat in a defective table and everybody else eats in a full table of three legs? So he challenges her with the dream. Amra lay, so she says to him, well, my nevet, what should we do? Same words that he used to ask her, my nevet, so he asked him, what should we do? By rachame, he asked for mercy, by rachame, nishkalindu minach, what should we do? Seek, and she tells him, what we should do is daven to get rid of this. By rachame, he daven ushkaluha, and they took it away. Tana, now we have this final interpolator. Gadol haya neis achron yosem in our rishon. The last neis was bigger than the first neis. It's a much bigger deal. The gemirei demeiv yaveh mishkalo shakli. Once the neis is done, it's harder to reverse it. So it's a bigger miracle to reverse the neis and to send the leg back up to Shemayim than to have the leg come down mina Shemayim. And that's the another interpolator. Again, I'll kind of analyze that, but that's the basic sugya according to one, the Dikduke Sofrim's Girsa. So, for starters, what's with the leg with three tables? How many legs does our table have here? Four. So why with the leg with three tables?
That's all you need.
What?
That's all you really need.
That's all you really need. But okay, so you need to do a little research. I did a little research, and it turns out that in ancient Greek and Roman times, most legs had three. Those tables had three legs. There you go. You could have a whole drush on why there were only three legs. It turns out that, in fact, that's the standard table in ancient times had three legs. Not to say that there's no significance in three and two. I think that there is. And I'll tell you why I say that. Because is the only way to describe a problematic table if by describing a table with missing a leg?
Well, it doesn't stand.
What? It
doesn't stand, though.
Doesn't stand, right? Well, if you don't shake it, I guess it could stand. But are there any other ways to describe a problematic table? Let's say a table, could tables be problematic even if they're not missing legs? Like, for example? What? What? Well, that would be a table. A rickety table, shaky, the legs are not tight. A teeny little table. Everybody, all that tzaddikim made it a big table, and we get in a little table. Right? So there are other ways for the Chazal to communicate a problematic table aside from the leg issue. I mean, on the other hand, of course, they need to get rid of. In other words, it could have focused on this differently. So the fact that there are legs and there are three, the Mefarshim will discuss three legs. The Marsha says the three legs are Torah, Voda, and Bilz Chasada. I don't know if the Marsha knew the nature of legs in ancient Greek and Roman times. So it could be he didn't know, so he had more of a kasha, why three? So he says that the Marsha says that if they use the leg, then there's something lacking in his avodas Hashem. Because he doesn't want pure avodas Hashem, he wants to have hanolam hazeh. That's the Marsha. Ruach HaChaim in his parish on that Mishnah Perkei Avos says that same thing, three, a Torah avodah gemilas chasadim, but what's missing is not the leg of avodas Hashem, what's missing is the leg of gemilas chasadim. Because the Ruach HaChaim, following the Derech HaKabbalah of the Gra, and Kabbalah in general, will say, if you take Shefaf, which is supposed to go to one place, and you direct it to another place, then that original place is lacking. So the Shefa that flowed from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to sustain the world was supposed to go to the whole world. And now that there's a Nes, it's going to Rechinina Mendoza and his wife, and that's subtracting from the overall Shefa of good that flows to the world. So that's Ruach Chaim's explanation. But be all that as it may, I think the question still stands, what's with the three and the two? The problem with these interpretations, to my mind, is that they take symbols from outside, so not from within the narrative itself. Okay, be all that as it may, let me just, it's a little late, so let me kind of try to finish up here. So, on this Girsa, he dreams, not surprising that he's a dreamer, because he's a great Kadosh, Tzaddik, he Ruach HaKodesh, so he sees things. But he challenges her. What should we do with this? Do you want to be in a place, according to the Gersa, do you want to be in a place where we don't have... So he's asking her. And what he's forcing her to do now, not forcing, that's the wrong word, what he is creating a context for her to do is to fully acknowledge the value of the life that they always led. He tells her, I had this dream. What do we do about it? Do you want to keep the leg so that we don't suffer? Or do you want not to keep the leg and you want to go back to the original life of Tsar? He asks her the question. She is now, in effect, positioned to determine whether she will autonomously, maturely, self-consciously choose the life that she led originally only out of pure deference to her great husband. Now he turns, if you don't mind the pun, the tables on her, and now she has to make a decision. And she chooses to have the table return to Shemayim. And so what we have is the arc of a journey. She started out as a deferential, as it were, kind of nice space Yaakov wife, follows the lead of her husband, whatever he says, good, no food, carobs, okay, we can live with that. Then this crisis in the kitchen pivots her to challenge and confront Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. And What I would argue, sometimes you need to challenge your religious assumptions in order to eventually affirm them. If you don't challenge your beliefs and the way you lead in your life, you just kind of go through the motions. She couldn't fully, in the end, autonomously affirm her commitment to a life of poverty, of living on carobs, until she questioned that life. She moved from her docile stance in the kitchen to challenge Rabbi Chanina Mendoza, and once she challenged him, he was able to bring her forward and enable her to come to affirm emotionally, I would suggest, as well as cognitively, the value of a life of asceticism and poverty. So by challenging her life, she was able to come to grips with its value in ways that she never could, and this dream is a vehicle for him to enable her to realize that the life she led is now a life that she wants to lead, wholeheartedly, fully identifying with. You see? So this Agadita traces the development of Rabbi Chanina Mendoza's wife. And Rabbi Chanina Mendoza is brilliant and empathetic and just a wonderful husband in enabling his wife to see for herself that she can choose, not because of him, not because he's a great tzaddik, but because she now realizes that she doesn't want to be at a table that's defective in the Olam Haba. There is this antithetical relationship between Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. If you have it in this world, you don't have it in the next world. If you have it in the next world, you don't have it in this world. You can't have it in both. That's his version. That's the Duke Sofer. According to Rashi, sees the dreamer. She sees that there's a defective table up in Shemayim. And what she comes to, she's not the great Ruach HaKodesh possessor of that Rukhina Mendoza. But why does she have the dream? What do people dream about? They dream about what bothers them. She's dreaming this, she's saying, why does this bother me? Why am I bothered by having, by leaving a life of poverty? She comes to realize the reason she's bothered by it, she's been down deep. That's really the life she wants to lead. That she wants to live. That's the why is she bothered by it? Sometimes you don't really know what you're feeling down deep until you think about what your anxieties are, what your worries are, what you dream about. This dream opened up a portal for herself, into herself, so that she could see that down deep she really believed in the life of Chanina Mendoza. So otherwise, why would she struggle and dream? And that enabled her to realize that down deep, she really believed in a life of poverty. And so her own dream enabled her to travel this journey from reactive, passive, to autonomous, mature affirmation of a life of poverty. I have more to say about this, but it's late, so I will just conclude with the following. Our Tana, our interpolator. So, how do you read this interpolation? What is he saying? That this is a greatness. What the interpolator, the Tana, is doing is he is expanding the miraculous aura of Rabbi Chanina Mendoza's wife. He is Lishitasa. Just like you couldn't imagine Rabbi Chanina Mendoza's wife as being any less than A-plus perfect tzaddikas, so too, Mulumedes benisa nisim all over the place, the Gadol Nesa Achlam and the Nesarish. I hear in it, in addition to that, something else, which is that if this is a story about the trajectory of Rabbi Chanina Mendoza's wife, from passive reactive to autonomous affirmation of a life of poverty, one could argue that that's the greatest miracle of all. Gadol Nes Acharon, Yosu Menen Nes HaRishon. Bringing a table is no bigadilla. When she said, return the table, what was she saying? She was saying that I personally affirm as an autonomous, mature person on my own that that table should go back to Shemayim because we should lead a life of poverty. And I think I hear an echo of a claim by the Tana, which is, I'm not saying it's just a literal intent, but in hearing the Agadita, that's the greatest miracle of all. That she could take that journey and that she could say, return the leg to Shemayim. And one final observation, in this light, in this spirit, the three legs, the two legs, why did the Gemara just say it was a rickety table, a short table, a big table, a table with six legs? Like, what's the three legs? How many partners are there in an ideal marriage? Three, namely, husband, the wife, and the Gemara in Sota, and the Shekhinah. The third leg of a marriage, of a wholesome good, is Shekhinah. Why? Because a husband and wife are united by their commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The ideals of a marriage, of transcending the mishigas of running a household and who's going to diaper the baby and whatever, and you know who's going to set the table or whatever, are all subsumed under the larger ideals that transcend and elevate a marriage. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, husband, wife, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Their marriage was missing a leg. The Shekhinah wasn't there. Why? Because they had different conceptions of what the Shekhinah required. He, Chanina ben Dosa, poverty, Olam Hazeh, Olam Haba, no Olam Hazeh, all Olam Haba. She is not feeling that. She's suffering. Their ideals are not in perfect sync. Put differently, they're worshiping a different HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who has different expectations for them. And their marriage tottered by virtue of it's lacking the leg of Shekhinah. And taking away the leg from Shemayim and giving it to them is to symbolize the weakness of their marriage. She wants the leg. She wants food. He's saying, I can live a life of poverty. To take that leg is to symbolize and make explicit in that sense the differences in their conception of what a Kaddish Baruch Hu want. To get the leg is to lose the fullness of the marriage in Olam Haba. When she says, return the leg, she's returning the Shekhinah to their marriage. And that, because now they share a common conception of the good. They share a common conception of what a Kaddish Baruch Hu wants. There is one Shekhinah in their house, not different Shekhinahs in their house, Kavi Yonko. And so the return of the leg and the taking of the leg is all a metaphor for describing the ways in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence can elevate, or the lack of a shared conception of Hashem's presence can ultimately render weak a marriage. And when she returned the leg to Shemayim, their marriage was reasserted, became solid and stable, and that is the Gadol HaNes HaAchron. That is ultimately one of the greatest nisim of all, that she could take this journey and she could return the leg of the table to Shemayim.
I read a couple of the chapters, which are very, very engaging.